Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So I watched George Bush on television this morning, and he's saying,
I want to reassure you, the investors out there,
nothing about the American public, nothing about, don't worry, your job's not going down the tubes. Nothing like, we're going to try and bring back those 6 million manufacturing jobs we've lost since I've been president. Nothing like, we created a house of cards, Phil and Wendy Graham, they gave us some bad advice. Nothing. Basically, and yesterday, Chris Matthews going ballistic at this poor Republican. The poor guy gets in his way. Why? Well, I guess that Matthews probably lost $1 million in the stock market. I mean, it's like when people's homes are going in the tank, we got a problem. When the people are unemployed, well, maybe there's a problem. When the rich get gouged, holy cow, there's righteous anger on television. Anyhow, welcome, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Extraordinary new book. It's going to be officially released in a couple of days, September 22nd. It's called Bear Trap, The Fall of Bear Stearns and the Panic of 2002 by Anonymous and Andrew Spencer, who helped write it, but Anonymous, the source for it. And Anonymous, also known as Bill Bamber, is with us on the line right now. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. I'm pronouncing Bamber right?
Yes, very good.
Okay.
Thank you.
You are anonymous in the book, but in reality, if I may out you here, and stop me if I shouldn't, you are...
No.
Okay.
My name's on the book. It's just I'm setting up the book. I was still there, in the process of exiting and...
You are the former senior managing director at Bear Stearns & Company. And by the way, for people who want to check out the book here, as it's just now becoming available in stores, BearTrapBook.com is the website for it. And you were on the inside.
Yes, I worked at Bear Stearns for 6 years. I was a senior managing director in the equity derivatives area of Bear Stearns. I headed up an area called equity derivative structuring.
And one of the things that I've read about Bear Stearns is that the CEO, whose name is escaping me at the moment.
Jimmy Cain,
right. Didn't he actually start out as like a scrap metal dealer and work his way
true.
Up?
That's a great intro to the firm. It has a reputation for being scrappy, for being a brick, as it were. And, history. And, a lot of that came from our former chairman, CEO, Ace Greenberg.
Right.
And, it was a tremendous, number of, characters, at that firm.
Yeah, this is a company that had a reputation for, you get in my way and I punch you in the face kind of thing.
Probably a little bit more of an urban legend there, but everybody I worked with there were tremendous. Some of the smartest people I've ever met worked at there.
So how did some of the smartest people you've ever met end up destroying a company?
That is a fantastic question. What we try to do in the book, Bear Trap, and the name of the book kind of lays it out. What we try to do is we try and trace through and connect this series of seemingly unrelated events that they are put together, conspire to take down the firm in a matter of 5 days. So it was really, it's not like everything was perfect, as we know. as we're seeing with Lehman Brothers, as we're seeing with some of the other firms on Wall Street, the housing bubble was collectively having a very large effect on basically that was slipping through to Wall Street, that this era of cheap money and very lax regulation on the origination of mortgages, that cascaded through into the kinds of securitization and the kinds of assets that were being held by major Wall Street firms like Bear Stearns. So they were certainly vulnerable. What happened with Bear was, it was really almost a classic run on the bank, as it were, in that rumor started, and they really took on a leg and became a self-fulfilling prophecy. So by that I mean, once there was no liquidity problem, but once people started to hear of a liquidity problem, it became a liquidity problem.
Sure.
Because funds.
Well, this is classically how runs on banks essentially happen.
It was very much a classic run, yeah.
You know, in the 1920s, in the roaring 20s, I'm sure you're not old enough to remember this. I'm not old enough to remember this. There are very few people around who are, but the history is certainly out there. In the late teens and early 20s, there was a series under a series of Republican presidents, a series of deregulations, essentially, the banking industry. And the banking industry was still, evolving and relatively new. The Fed didn't even come into existence until 1913. That allowed for speculation, not just in stock, as everybody thinks of, the crash in 29 and the Republican Great Depression as a stock market crash, but it really started in the housing market in Florida. And yeah, we've lost Bill Bamber. He's catching a plane. He's in a using his cell phone. So we'll try and get him back on. But anyhow, I'll continue the wrap here. In the teens and 20s, the 19 teens and the 1920s. There was this explosion in the value of real estate in Florida. And people from all over the country were trying to buy real estate in Florida to flip it, to speculate on it. And this bubble started to burst in 1927 and led directly to the bursting of the stock market in 1929 and the Great Depression, the Republican Great Depression of the early 1930s. And it's like we are seeing this all over again. It's deja vu all over again. So, Bill, you're back with us. I was just saying, in the 20s, there was this explosion in asset values, housing asset values. It started in Florida. It spread to about a dozen other states throughout the early 20s. In 1927, that bubble began to burst, and there is a really good, incredible body of evidence that the bursting of the housing bubble in 1927 is what led to the stock market crash in 29. We're seeing, history repeat itself here. Didn't anybody wave any flags?
There were some people waving flags, and certainly at Bear, people were in the mode of adjusting, certainly with respect to Bear Stearns, starting to try and move away from the dependency on that real estate or mortgage origination business, what have you, process of diversifying more into commodities, emerging markets, etc. And then, the tsunami, as it were, came on very quickly. Bear Stearns stock is trading at $70 on the Friday before the run started. At the end of that, by the close the following Friday, it was $30 by that Sunday night. And Bear was taken over by J.P. Morgan. At that point, it was $2.
Do you think that this could have been people either inside J.P. Morgan or simply predators on the outside who were running naked shorts and other forms of basically gambling against Bear that had either enough power or cumulatively reached so much momentum that it drove down Bear as a consequence?
I don't believe that aspect of it. Suspicious activity, particularly in the deep out of the money option market. The March 20 expiry puts that had $30 strike. So, when the stock was trading in the $60 range in those early days, Monday, March the 10th, Tuesday the 11th, there had been zero activity in those very, very cheap puts. I mean, they were almost worthless because they were so close to expiry. And all of a sudden started to see tremendous volume in those 2,000 money puts. I mean, when I say cheap, I mean, you know, less than 1% of the stock's value, you know, 50 basis points, 80 basis points.
Well, whoever bought those puts made a whole pile of money.
It was like winning probably one of the largest lotteries ever. Yeah. And you normally don't see a lot of activity in those deep all the money puts were so close to expiry. So there was definitely, you know, that in conjunction with obviously rumors being spread. And then, you know, look, we live in an era of, you know, 24/7 business news. And so, yeah. You know, this is, you know, it was.
Bill, we just have a couple of seconds left. More to come. You predicted the fall of Lehman and others. More to come. Is this just the beginning?
I think we're close to the end. What we're starting to see now is this next phase where, you know, fortunately, people like John Thain and John Mack have, in effect, gone on the offense and preempted a lot of these attacks and, or in the case of Merrill, merged with BHC in America. And now we're hearing rumors of a potential merger involving Morgan Stanley and Wachovia. So, you know, we're probably not out of the woods yet. You know, there's
so,
a lot
so
of...
So the bottom line is, even if we're not out of the woods, what we're going to end up with is probably six or eight massive financial companies that control the United States banking system.
And I think so.
It's like Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. I mean, it's consolidation by violence almost.
I think that's by design right now. You know, there needs to be, everyone recognizes there needs to be greater security within the financial market in the coming years. And so one of the ways to do that is to have less firms and have more consolidation.
Over the short term, perhaps, you know, but on the other hand, then you've got, I mean, even the bigger they are, the farther they'll fall. I think, frankly, we need to bring the Sherman Act out. But Bill Bamber, he is a former senior managing director of Bear Stearns. The book is The Bear Trap, BearTrapBook.com for information. Thanks, Bill.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Congress on the minimum wage and see how long they can last. Let them try to rely on the minimum wage and see them change it, rearrange it, wow, real fast. And when they say that the pay makes it tough to survive, we're telling them, hey, it keeps you alive. When they cry that they try, but they can't get ahead, we'll send a social worker to pat them on the head. They'd be poor, but I'm sure it would be all the rage if we put Congress on the minimum wage.
Now, this is a plan for you. Put Congress on
now, those right-wing fundamentals.
22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. John McCain was asked about Hugo Chavez and a few other people in an interview on Spanish radio yesterday. And then they asked him about Mr. Zapatero, the Prime Minister, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, the Prime Minister of Spain. And his response was something to the effect of, well, I don't know, we're going to have to think very carefully about whether or not we're going to talk to anybody, that, you know, who we're going to... Basically, he didn't realize he was talking about the Prime Minister of Spain. I mean, you know, this is the bottom line. I mean, you know, he says, I will meet with those leaders who are our friends and who want to work with us cooperatively. I will reunite with any leader that has the same principles and philosophies that we do, human rights, democracy, and liberty, and I will confront those who don't have them. So, you know, obviously he didn't know who he was talking about. He didn't know that this guy was the who is the Prime Minister of Spain. And frankly, probably most Americans don't have any idea that Zapatero is the President of Spain. It's not a name that's in the news every day. So now Randy Shuneman comes out. You know, the guy who was the lobbyist for Georgia all those years, $800,000 from Georgia, and good buddies with Saakashvili and all that. He comes out and says that actually McCain wasn't confused. He simply refuses to meet with the Spanish Prime Minister. He was just articulating his policy of refusing to commit a White House meeting with President Zapatero. I mean, this is nuts. You have a candidate for President of the United States saying, I'm not sure I'm going to meet with any of the European leaders. It's actually tragic. And as always, the McCain camp, they're basically doubling down on a bad bet. Speaking of doubling down, Chuck Hagel, you know, the guy who used to own or be the president of the company that became ES&S, which counts most of the votes in America, Chuck Hagel, the Republican. You want a maverick. Here's a guy who, as a Republican, stood up to his own party, so much so that he actually even decided not to run again for re-election to Congress. The Republican who has spoken out strongly against the war in Iraq. In many ways, frankly, I think, as a politician, in many ways, if you set aside, I mean, all his right-wing votes, at least with regard to the war, a reasonably good guy in some regards. They asked him, what about John McCain? What about Sarah Palin? Particularly, what do you think about Sarah Palin? This was an interview with the Omaha World Herald. And Senator Chuck Hagel, the Republican senator from Nebraska, said, and I quote, I do think in a world that is so complicated, so interconnected, and so combustible, you really got to have some people in charge that have some sense of the bigger scope of the world. I think that's just a requirement. So they said, well, does that describe Sarah Palin? And he said, I think it's a stretch to, in any way, to say that she's got the experience to be president of the United States. And so then they pointed out that she says, well, you can see Russia from Alaska. Hagel says, an answer like that is insulting to the American people. I think they ought to just be honest about it and stop the nonsense, and I look out my window and I see Russia, and so therefore I know something about Russia. That kind of thing is insulting to the American people. He says, you got a passport for the first time in your life last year? I mean, I don't know what you can say. You can't say anything. This is the Republican, Chuck Hagel, the Republican senator, saying that the Republican Sarah Palin, running for vice president, along with John McCain, to continue the policies of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, not really qualified to be president. Well said. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
So they say they deserve to have their day. They would like us all just to go away. That's one thing we won't do. 'Cause we've got a war to end. An environment needs the men. We need to do all that we can to protect the right to choose. Brothers and sisters who are gay deserve to have their wedding day. We need to be assured health care for all will be insured. I'm a blue state liberal with progressive views. Watch PBS to get my news. Air America's on all day long. It's time for moving on. Liberal is not a dirty word. Contrary to what you may have heard, we're gonna stand and shout out loud. We're liberal and we're proud.
I love it. It's 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my, oh, my. Over in Russia, they have suspended their stock exchange trading. Actually, two different exchanges. They put them on pause. The Russian market is collapsing. They're freaking out. What's going on over there? Medvedev and Putin are getting together. They're talking about dumping $60 billion into some of the state-owned banks. They're experiencing a liquidity crisis, and they're sitting on some of the largest stockpiles of not just nuclear weapons but also gold in the world. That should be interesting. Gold yesterday had apparently its largest one-day rise in history, if not damn close to it, and it seems to have stabilized now, although I expect that we will see more. Bush coming out this morning, giving his speech, saying, everything's fine. We're going to do whatever we can. I'm going to cancel my appointment so I can sit here all day and watch what's going on. As if he had a clue. As if he had a friggin' clue. What we are seeing is nothing more or less than the absolute destruction of the economy of the United States and, by extension, the economy of the world, in large part because of insane economic policies that were first put forth as theories by Friedrich von Hayek back in the 1920s and 1930s, picked up on by Milton Friedman in the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s, advanced by Alan Greenspan, and popularized by people like Tom Friedman and Ronald Reagan. And they first entered the bloodstream, the national bloodstream of a couple of countries, with Margaret Thatcher in 1978, as I recall. I think she was elected prime minister in 78 or 79, and Ronald Reagan in 1980 in the United States. And they've been, and country after country that has adopted these insane, what we call in America conservative, what in Europe they refer to as neoliberal policies, new liberalism, these insane conservative or neoliberal policies. Country after country that has adopted them has seen what? They have seen their manufacturing base disintegrate. They have seen their financial services sector be essentially the only and last source of wealth, and it is a source of wealth built on a house, built as a house of cards. Pardon my mixing metaphors there, but you get the point. It doesn't work. You gotta make stuff. Meanwhile, the countries that are doing exactly what Reagan said don't ever do, exactly what Phil Graham and John McCain and all these other gee whiz right-wing economic think they know something about it have said don't ever do, the stuff that Tom Friedman said don't ever do, the countries that have been protecting themselves. You want to import a car into China? Good luck. 22% import tariff. You want to import a car from China into the United States? It's only a 2% tariff. No problem. You can sell Chinese cars here. And they will. Japan protected their economy in the 1960s, the 1970s, the 1980s. They started dropping their protections in the late 90s, in the mid-90s. And what happened? Boom, they went into a 10-year recession. Korea is still protecting their economy. China is protecting their economy. In India, it is illegal, illegal for one company or family to own more than one retail store. Excuse me, more than two retail stores. So how many Walmarts do they have in India? Two. Why? Because they want to protect the private sector. They want to protect small businesses, small and medium-sized businesses. And you got people in the United States, you know, the Tom Friedmans of the world, the Ronald Reagans of the world, but Reagan's gone, but, you know, his heirs remain, going, oh, it's crazy. And then on top of that, you've got the commons. Whether it's a bridge in Minneapolis or whether it's the banking system or whether it's our public education system, Grover Norquist's fondest dream, as he said to Mara Liasson in May of 2002 on NPR, on National Republican Radio, he said, we just want to shrink government down to the size where you can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub. Well, Grover, you got your dream. So what are they doing now? Well, they got to pull this thing back together. So, well, let's just print some money. Print a whole lot of money. And they're going to print a whole lot of money, and the result is going to be either something that's going to make 1930 look like just an absolute screaming picnic. And it may still anyway, because we don't have a manufacturing base to fall back on. In 1930, we did. Or something that is going to look very much like what the Weimar Republic of Germany saw in the 1920s, massive inflation. It's too early, frankly, in my opinion, to predict how this is all going to play out, but it sure is looking to me like, at the very least, the Japanese scenario, a prolonged and protracted recession, unless we start learning the lessons of the past. There's just some real simple stuff here we can do. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Gene in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Gene, what's on your mind today? Gene? Sounds like Gene's not there. Okay, Ben in Rockville, Maryland. Hey, Ben, what's on your mind today?
Well, actually, it's funny you mentioned Ronald Reagan, because when I was a young boy, I got a commemorative keepsake bicentennial edition of the American Constitution with an introduction by Ronald Reagan. And it specifically states in the Constitution, which I read last night cover to cover, that only Congress has the power of the purse. So where does the Fed get off, the Federal Reserve, you know, raising the debt of every man, woman, and child in America by $1,100 per person? $400 billion is what the Fed's committed of my taxpayer dollars, and I didn't have a vote.
Yeah.
Where do they have the authority to do that?
Well, there's subtle distinctions here. The Fed is not using taxpayer dollars. The Fed is using dollars. And so there's a difference. Congress, you're absolutely right. In the Constitution, it says only Congress can appropriate funds and spend funds. And it also says that only Congress can establish, you know, the bank, you know, banking for the currency of the United States. The Fed is essentially borrowing money against their own assets. And there's some question now about how good their own assets are. This is where it starts getting really scary. This doesn't even have anything to do with that. That the Fed is sitting only on $800 billion worth of assets, and some of those are securities, are, you know, mortgage securities. But the Fed, because we have this fractional banking system, basically our banking system is based on debt. Every time debt is created, more money is created. So the Fed borrows, the Fed allows its banks to create more credit, to loan money out, and that actually creates money. The Congress does not have to appropriate money for the Fed to create money. Fed is doing is they're making money out of thin air. They're using the system, the fractional banking system. Every time, if you go to the bank right now and borrow $1,000, the bank basically creates about $980 of that out of thin air. And all of a sudden, the amount of money that the United States has is larger. The money supply of the United States is larger. And this is one of the big problems. This is why everybody's so hysterical about deflation, is as money goes away. I mean, $1 trillion vanished from our stock market yesterday, but that's nothing, frankly, compared to the amount of money that could vanish in all these mortgages, you know, which is, you know, probably more like $10 trillion. And as that money goes away, the money supply contracts. If the money supply contracts, that's a loss of liquidity, is the phrase the bankers use. The money supply contracts, it means ultimately that the money becomes more valuable. That's what happened during the Great Depression. Money became the most valuable thing. The people who had cash were in reasonably good shape. Everybody else was screwed. They were out of luck. And so as the value of money goes up, you could buy a loaf of bread with a few cents, and because money became more and more valuable. And there's a danger to that. That's called deflation. Just like there's a danger to money becoming less valuable, which is inflation. When the Fed just creates money out of thin air using their ability to do so with credit, they risk inflation. They risk, you know, by adding to the money supply. But they're, you know, the delicate balancing act that I'm quite sure they're trying to do is they're saying, okay, how much money vanished from the system by the stock market crashing? How much money is vanishing from the system by all these defaults on these mortgages? If we create money out of thin air and it's the same amount of money, then we're not going to create either inflation or deflation, and we can walk this tightrope. But nobody really knows, because they don't know how much of that money is going to vanish. They don't know how far south the home values are going to go. They don't know how bad this is going to be in the stock market. So it's all a massive amount of guesswork. And if they guess right, they might be able to slide us through this thing. It's like threading a needle you know, in a 100-mile-an-hour wind, right? It's going to be a very, very difficult time. And the reason why is because all of this stuff was set up by all this insane deregulation. There were things in place up until Phil Gramm, with the Gramm-Leach-Biley Act, I think it was called, up until Phil Gramm in 1999, you know, did away with Glass-Steagall, for example, among other things. And the former ways that the trading of securities were monitored and controlled. There used to be protections against this stuff. Those protections no longer exist. And we're going to have to bring them back. I mean, it's just that simple. And get some control over this system. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Save us from the lies. Save our homes from foreclosing. Stop feeding us as spies. Save our jobs from leaving. Bring back made in USA. Represent the ones who made you, not the ones who pave your way.
Sounds like a plan. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here. Defending the world from the weapons of mass deception. Pat in La Miranda, California.
Hey, Tom, how we doing?
Just fine. Hey, what's up, Pat?
Hey, Tom, I have a few questions for you. I'm a Hispanic fella, a businessman for almost 40 years, and I've done very well because I've worked and not depended on my color or my skin. I'm a dark Hispanic fella, used to be a fireman, but I went to work. And, you know, I need some help. I want to vote for I want to vote for someone like me. But I read about the background of Obama, and, you know, we go to Muslims. We're in a ministry that goes to Muslims, and they all say he's a Muslim. And then we have some ex-Muslims that are speaking with us, and they all say that he's a Muslim.
Pat, are you calling from the RNC?
No.
Come on, give me a break.
No. We do.
You know, only crazy people are saying that Barack Obama is a Muslim. He's
not
a Muslim.
Well, he said he was. He said, you mean my Muslim faith with Stephanopoulos?
And then he misspoke, and he immediately corrected himself.
Okay, you know, but I'm nervous about this now.
Get over it.
Okay, I'm trying to, but help me out on this. He's pro-abortion, which is the killing of
babies. He's not a pro-abortion. Nobody's pro-abortion. In fact, he's in favor of doing things that will decrease the number of abortions.
Okay, that's good.
What he is
good.
In favor of is a woman, if she is raped or if she's a victim of incest or, for that matter, you know, has an unplanned pregnancy, in the early stages of that pregnancy, having the right to abort that child. That's the position of the Democratic Party.
Okay, Tom, help me on this. This fellow named Rezko, a Syrian guy that funded his first 5 campaigns,
he didn't fund his first 5 campaigns. He was one of many, many donors. You know, Pat, you're calling here with all the talking points. It's not going to work. People are seeing past this stuff. People are getting it that you guys try to slap all this stuff on Obama, and it's not going to stick because the guy is a decent man. He has a good political record. He has a good legislative record. I mean,
why did they get $150 million from the Middle East? From Islamics.
Well, they didn't. You know, they didn't. Again, I mean, Pat, you gotta stop reading these weird emails because I'm telling. Check them over at factcheck.org or go check them at Fight the Smears or something. I mean, it's like some of you guys are like on hallucinogens. It is so strange. It's like the '60s all over again. I mean, here I am in San Francisco. It's like. And man, it's like people are tripping. I don't get it. Gary in Seattle. Hey, Gary.
Oh, hi, Tom. Listen, I could I make an announcement first?
Sure.
It's an environmental thing up on the north end of Seattle. There's a rally to save the Waldo Woods at 5.
Okay.
Come out to the Waldo. But anyway,
great.
That guy is just, you know, I would ask these right-wing types, these evangelical types, why is it that they take the Old Testament literally, but they take the New Testament, you know, the part about helping the poor and, and all that figuratively, like, oh, he didn't really mean that, you know. Yeah. I mean, what's up with that?
Well, what's up with it is there's a half a dozen websites out there that list all the liberal talk show hosts and the phone numbers to call in and talking points that you can use to call them.
Yeah.
And by the way, frankly, liberals have done this in the past, you know, to Rush Limbaugh. You know, but it's the sad thing about it is that when liberals get through onto Limbaugh's show or onto Hannity or something like that, you know, sometimes they'll make a pretty good point. These are not even good points. There are some areas where I will agree with people who are going to criticize Obama. I mean, at least, come on, call with something intelligent, you know.
Yeah.
Call and say, you know, can't we agree that the FISA vote was stupid?
Yeah.
But anyhow, Gary, that's not what you were calling about.
Well, I was actually calling just to say that what amazes me is that the Republicans, just as you say, they've worked for years and years to undermine the middle class, and then the last straw was these phony mortgages that make people, you know, look like they can afford these houses, and now it's all come due and they're saying, what happened? As if they don't know anything about it, and now McCain suddenly is a big reformer guy. I mean, come on.
Well, they're not even saying what happened. What they're saying is it's greedy homeowners.
Oh, yeah, and, that's it. You know, that's it. Not the guys who are making out and taking the money.
Especially low-income homeowners. Oh, we were just trying to help. You know, we had to be able, there was redlining going on. We had to go into poor neighborhoods and give people loans because the liberals were screaming. And so we gave them loans, and now they can't pay. Come on, give me a break,
well,
guys.
Well, Palin is looking worse and worse in the teeth of events now. I mean, what the hell? Yeah. She looks like she barely knows anything about anything, you know.
Well, she does barely know anything about anything, obviously, because if she knew anything at all, she would have made herself available to the public. So, yeah, Gary, you know, spot on. I mean, it's a tragedy. It's a, well, we'll see. Actually, you know, she's dropped, what, 12 points in the polls, I think, in the last week. Rob in Virginia, Minnesota.
Good morning. I know exactly what the problem is.
Okay.
It's you.
Okay.
You take off for 5 days, and the whole world goes to hell in a handbasket.
Hey, I did my show live on Monday from Lima,
Peru.
No,
I mean, really, this is serious. I'm sorry. I talked to you about 10 months ago, and it's where I think I told you at that time is where we're going to have to pay a high price for all of this conservative ideology. And now my how can I say, my roosters, my hens are coming home to roost or something like that.
Hey, listen, Rob, you know, I've been singing this song. I wrote Unequal Protection in 1998, I think, or 1999. Yeah, I've been saying this for a decade that the roof is going to fall in because these guys, their economic policies are nuts.
Yeah,
trickle down economics.
People think that we're on the bottom right now. This train is going downhill without any brakes, and we're not even there yet.
No, we're not even halfway there, in my opinion. Trickle-down economics produces only one thing, and that's a nation of peons.
Hey, Tom, do me a favor.
Yeah.
Don't leave the country anymore.
Yeah, okay. Rob, thanks a lot for the call. I'll do my best. Kevin in New Jersey. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Enjoy your show. I'm got you streaming.
Oh, okay. Kevin, hey, I'm sorry. I missed the time cue there, and we just have to wrap up the hour. But we will be taking more calls as the day goes on, so I'll put you back on hold. We'll get back to you. It's going to be an interesting day. It's going to be a very, very interesting day here. Coming up next, Mark Krikorian with the Center for Immigration Studies. My sister-in-law became a U.S. citizen yesterday. Let's talk about that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our program. Mark Krikorian is with us. He's the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, CIS.org, is their website. And looking at their website, I see he also is the author of a book, The New Case Against Immigration, Both Illegal and Legal. Mark, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
My sister-in-law became a U.S. citizen yesterday.
Well, congratulations.
Why is that a bad thing?
It's not a bad thing. Once we have admitted people from abroad, we want them to become Americans. That's kind of the whole point, the reason we permit immigration. The question is, upstream, if you will, what should our policy be tomorrow for immigration? In other words, is it sensible to keep letting in 1.5 million people a year? And I argue that the answer is no. And it's not because today's immigrants are somehow less desirable than those of the Ellis Island era, for instance, but because we've changed in good ways and bad ways, but we've changed, we've grown up as a society, and mass immigration is just not compatible with a mature, developed society like ours in a way that wasn't necessarily true when we were settling the land and industrializing our cities.
Well, in the 1800s, wow, my voice is really loud in my headphones, and yours is really faint, so maybe John can do something about that. In the 1800s, the population of the entire planet was under 1 billion, and just a little over 1 billion. We hit 1 billion people in the year 1800. We hit our second billion people in the year 1930. Our third billion was 1960. So the year John Kennedy was sworn in, there were only 3 billion people on the planet. There's now almost 7 billion people on the planet.
Right.
So, and the population of the United States when Kennedy was sworn in, as I recall, was under 200 million people. I'd have to go back and look at the numbers.
Something like that. Yeah, but, now we're over 300 now.
Right, we're over 300. We're pushing on 350.
Right.
Or 340, whatever it is. And you know, at a certain point, you know, technology can make it possible for more people to live in a smaller amount of space, but particularly technology when it comes to food. But we're running out of topsoil all over the planet. We're getting low on some energy resources. There are others. People are looking at solar and things like that where they're saying, hey, there's unlimited potential. But the bottom line is, frankly, it seems to me like this isn't just in the United States. That the developed countries all over the world are struggling with immigration. I certainly have seen it in Italy and Spain and the countries that are having large numbers of mostly illegal immigrants, in many cases in France, you know, because they had Algeria, and in England with India and Pakistan, legal immigration because of their colonial policies. They're really struggling with all these immigrants coming in. And on the other hand, you have undeveloped countries, third world countries, that are dealing with the crisis of exploding populations. Isn't that really the issue here rather than immigration or not immigration?
Well, I mean, that's part of it, but it's really only one facet of it. It's not as simple as saying that a country with a really high birth rate, the people are going to kind of overflow like, too much water in a glass or something. Because for instance, look at Mexico, which now has what's called a total fertility rate. That's the average number of kids the average woman would have during her lifetime. The total fertility rate in Mexico is a little more than 2. It's the same as it is here in the United States. It's been falling dramatically, and yet at the same time that it's been dropping, immigration has been increasing dramatically from Mexico. So population growth in the third world is part of the equation, but it's just one part of what
drives the immigration that has been coming into the United States. The position that I've taken on this, and as a liberal talk show host and author here, you may be surprised to discover that in many regards, probably you and I agree in many of these areas rather than disagree. Just looking at David Ricardo in 1818, you know, his iron law of wages. You know, basically that when the amount of labor equals the demand for labor, the cost of labor goes to subsistence. In other words, it goes to the floor.
So right.
It goes to everybody becomes the working poor. There is no middle class. The only thing that creates a middle class is a slight shortage of labor. And the history of the creation of the middle class in the United States is the history of the creation of that slight shortage of labor. It was done in a whole variety of ways. It was done in ways that are arguably criminal and certainly immoral. For example, apartheid. Not allowing African Americans into the workplace, not allowing women into the workplace.
Sure.
It was done by labor unions saying, okay, only people in our club can join, and you know, arguably more legal, but you know, because everybody could participate in that, but they were able to control the workforce available to that business, so the business had to pay higher wages. But mostly, the bottom line really is just the ratio of the amount of workforce to the amount of people, and we've had trade policies in this country now since Reagan, in large part. We had 30 years of trade policies, and Bill Clinton really put them on steroids with the WTO and NAFTA and GATT, that have said that that have incentivized companies to move jobs overseas. And so what's happened is the supply of labor now exceeds the demand for labor, and so the cost of labor is crashing. And so immigration it becomes part of the problem rather than part of the solution or part of anything. But I would say that it's not, you know, immigration is only, you know, it's probably less than 20% of the disaster that's happening to the middle class, maybe not even 10%. It's really these insane trade policies that are causing our manufacturing jobs to go overseas.
Well, I'm not a trade scholar, but I know some people. I mean, there are some economists who've looked at the effect on the wages of low-skilled workers in the United States and the effect of trade and the effect of immigration. And from what I've seen, now, again, this is just what I've read, is that immigration is actually a significantly bigger impact than trade. That may or may not be true.
Well, it depends on the types of jobs you're talking about.
But the other side, too, is that when you look at the effects, you can't just look at wages paid by employers. You have to look at broader social costs that taxpayers have to bear. And a modern society like ours, for instance, isn't going to let people die in front of an emergency room on the street. That's why we have federal law that requires all emergency rooms to take any comer, legal, illegal, poor, rich, doesn't matter. That's a good thing. I like living in a society with a law like that. But what we're doing is putting more and more stress on our various social institutions. At some point, it's just not viable.
Right. But the argument that is often made by people without trying to sound too polarized here, on your side of the argument, the anti-immigration
Sure.
argument, and because I'm in favor of regulated and controlled immigration that is done in a way that, on the one hand, is compassionate, that I don't think that we're allowing anywhere near enough refugees, real refugees, in particularly the ones that we have created.
Right.
And on the other hand, that doesn't dilute our workforce to the point where our labor costs collapse. But really, what you guys talk about is the immigrants, the illegal immigrants, as the bad guys. And I would submit to you that we do not have an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States. If 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 CEOs of companies that were hiring illegal immigrants, if people like Gordon Smith, the senator from Oregon, whose company, Smith Frozen Foods, which has made him a multimillionaire, if Gordon Smith were put in prison because his company is hiring and has been for many years hiring illegal immigrants, if the latest reporting from Willamette Week, some very, very good investigative reporting that was done just reported last week,
mm-hmm.
if he was put in prison for that, I guarantee you that those jobs that Smith Frozen Foods has been offering, that Gordon Smith's company has been offering, would go away, and that the quote, illegal immigrants would say, hey, you know, I can't get a job here. I'm going to go back home. I'm going to go back to Mexico or Guatemala or whatever, and I'm out of here. See you later.
Yeah,
and,
no, I'm completely with you.
And the problem.
Yeah.
We don't have an illegal immigrant problem here. We have an illegal employer problem here in the United States.
I agree, but you got to understand. I mean, let's not objectify the illegal immigrants either. I mean, they are people, and they are moral actors. They're making this decision, but I do agree.
But they're making a decision, as we all do, within the framework of a system, and the system has been set up so that Gordon Smith never gets punished, but if Pablo, who's working at his factory, gets caught without his papers, Pablo gets shipped off to some Department of Homeland Security detention center.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying the corollary can't be Pablo doesn't get arrested. The corollary has to be that everybody who's responsible here needs to be punished. But let me just
if you put Gordon Smith in prison, Pablo's job is going to go away and he's
sure.
going to go home.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You don't have to deport illegal aliens. You simply stop hiring them and they will leave. They know how to get out of here. They know how to get into here.
I don't disagree with you.
Okay, well, interesting. Mark Krikorian, CIS.org is the website. His book, The New Case Against Immigration, Both Legal and Illegal. Interesting conversation, Mark. Thanks for dropping by.
Well, thank you, Tom.
866-303-2270, our telephone number, 16 minutes past the hour, TomHartmann.com. Going to drop into our live chat room. We'll continue the conversation about immigration, about the economy, about politics, about John McCain, right after this.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
There's a day. It's a paradise I find that sets me loose. Oh, ain't it the truth? It's a place out on the ocean. It's a mansion with a view. But all that I can think about is you.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, it's getting dirty. James Inhofe running anti-gay, implicitly anti-gay ads. Sort of like John McCain running these sleazy ads against Barack Obama. You know, the sex education ads. I'm telling you, the Republicans, they're having to dip into the dirt this time around. It's just, well, not just this time around, every time around, because the Republican agenda is fundamentally an un-American agenda. Let me qualify that, because that sounds a little too Limbaugh-ish. The Republican agenda is fundamentally an anti-working class agenda. It is an agenda that is of, by, and for Americans, but only a very small slice of Americans. Very wealthy Americans, very powerful Americans, very corporate Americans. That's the Republican agenda. And then they try to bring in a few suckers here and there. Hey, you know, let's see if we can get the, you know, the folks who, you know, religion is a major part of their lives. Let's try and get them in. People who are concerned about abortion, let's try and get them in. People who are afraid of gay people, let's get them in. People who are afraid of people of color, let's get them in. People who are afraid of people of different religions, let's try to get them in. So they try to build this coalition of the fearful. You know, it's like the coalition of the willing then became the coalition of the billing. You know, with regard to the wars, and now the Republican coalition is a coalition of the fearful. And immigration is another piece of that. To try to get the people, oh, they're afraid of brown people, they're afraid of people who have, you know, different skin color, people who speak a different language. Let's bring them in, too. We do not have an illegal immigration problem or immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in this country. And it's not only not helping the United States that we have employers who are exploiting people who are fearful that they will be exposed, and so therefore they're willing to work under conditions that they would not work under if they were citizens. It also isn't helping their sending countries, because some of the best and brightest from Mexico and Guatemala and El Salvador and, you know, fill in the blank, south of here, the people who actually had the courage to say, you know, I'm going to take a chance for my family, I'm going to try and build a better life, came here in the hopes of doing that. And had they stayed in those countries, then I think, frankly, you know, if you didn't have 10, 12 million Mexicans in the United States right now, people who are in many cases, in most cases, relatively progressive in their outlook, and certainly have the potential to be very nationalistic, to care about their country, to want to see it move forward. I don't think that you would have seen Calderon. I don't think that you would see a right winger get elected president of Mexico. I mean, these are folks who need to be in their country being politically active. But see, Mexico is experiencing many of the same problems we are, because they bought into the same thing. The whole thing with NAFTA, the whole NAFTA thing was, you know, it's destroying the middle class there, too. Initially, it looked good. All these jobs, all these factories and things, you know, let's build some car factories down there. Well, now they're moving them to China. And when China gets too expensive, they'll move them to Burma. I mean, you know, where's the next dictatorship that we can go to get cheap labor? And in the United States, we used to protect our labor forces by saying that if you wanted to import things from countries where labor was cheaper, you had to pay an import tariff that represented the differential of that labor cost. And we no longer do that. So now it's in fact, we even give tax incentives to companies that ship jobs overseas. Tax incentives that John McCain wants to expand and that Barack Obama wants to do away with. These are some pretty clear differences. Where it gets dangerous, where it gets destructive, is when it gets into the whole phobia thing, the xenophobia, the hatred, the fear, the fundamentally naked racism. Let's just call it what it is. And that's where you find Republicans really exploiting this. But there are very real issues that have to do with immigration, and we need to have an honest discussion about it in this country. And in a way that does acknowledge the fact that we are a nation of immigrants and that immigration can be a good thing for any nation. Cross-fertilization and pollination and all that sort of thing and cultural diversity. And yet at the same time, that maintains the integrity of the national workforce, that maintains the integrity of the economy, that maintains the integrity of our core values, that says that this is our country, this is what our country is all about. Every country does this. Every country surrounds itself with a membrane, essentially. An economic membrane, a cultural membrane, a language membrane, and says, this is who we are. And we're proud of it. And we're going to make it work. And we're going to make it work for all of us. Until you have some multinational corporation coming along, or some guy like Gordon Smith coming along and saying, hey, you know, I can make an extra $1 million by screwing with the system. And in the process, thousands of lives are damaged or destroyed. Working class lives, I don't think Gordon Smith cares so much about that. But lives. 27 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Some political observers are calling his most ironic speech of the 2008 campaign. GOP presidential nominee John McCain today lashed out at Washington at the Republican Party and a group of insiders he referred to as old men with white hair. It's time to take our country back, Senator McCain told his audience in Dayton, Ohio. Time to send a message to those in power, those Republicans in Washington, those old men with their combed-over white hair. Senator McCain went on to attack the power elite on Wall Street, calling them wealthy plutocrats with private jets and too many houses to keep track of. The time has come, he said, to say enough is enough to these rich old white men. And the same goes to their zombie-like trophy wives who plaster their makeup on like trollops. Responding to the nation's economic turmoil, Senator McCain said that as president, he would create millions of jobs by putting Americans to work making negative ads. We no longer lead the world in manufacturing cars, making steel, manufacturing computers, but, said Senator McCain, our negative ad industry is second to none. In other economic news, President Bush announced another massive bailout, saying he had completed a deal for China to buy the United States in its entirety. This was a difficult deal to pull off, Mr. Bush acknowledged. The hard part was identifying the parts of the U.S. that China didn't already own. Yeah, well, with the tip of the hat to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. And thank you, Andy, for letting us use your tongue-in-cheek news in the news. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Lee in Yonkala, Oregon.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Lee.
Did you catch the first sentence of that anti-Obama caller? He said, I'm Hispanic.
Right.
I work.
Right.
I don't depend on my color.
Yeah, I know.
He's saying that Hispanics and African American don't work normally.
I know. It was so full of code, and at every point I was going to stop him. He had he had told the call screener that he wanted to talk about a specific issue, and it was an issue, and I don't remember what it was now, frankly, but it was an issue that I thought would be a good debate. I knew he was going to disagree with me, and I thought it would be a really interesting debate to have. But he never got around to it. And finally, after, you know, the fourth or fifth calling talking point, I just cut him off.
But, you know, he gave away what Republicans really are, racist. I mean,
yeah.
Not counting the first sentence, those were Republican talking points. But he let himself slip in the first sentence.
Yeah.
It was terrible. And then, you know, 40 soldiers have been killed in the last 6 weeks. And I have not seen one report on Yahoo News. You would think that it's over, you know. Still 40 soldiers in 6 weeks. And it's like a media blackout.
Yeah, and here's another media blackout for you. The media, the Department of Homeland Security has created no-fly zones over parts of Galveston Island and some of the islands nearby. And, you know, the speculation is that there are bodies floating in the water and they don't want photos of them.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, they're down there saying to the media, you go into these areas, you fly an airplane over these areas, you take pictures of these areas, you will go to prison.
Wow.
And so it is New Orleans all over again, and they don't want it reported, just like they don't want the war reported. Good point, Lee. Thank you very much for the call. You know, well said. Chuck in San Jose. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
Hello?
Hey, Chuck, you're on the air.
Yeah, I got a loud scratch. I'm just curious. I think what we're seeing is the advanced acceleration of old money limiting the number of members in the new money club. When you look at Europe and the old world, it took them centuries to accumulate the wealth they have, kings, queens, wars, whatnot. Well, what happened in the U.S. when we established the U.S. is that it opened up the door for some people to actually become part of the ultra extremely rich.
Right, the Rockefellers and Mellons.
Yeah, and they're getting tired of too many people joining the rich club. So what they're doing is they're accelerating it worldwide so that those that can hang on, those are the ones who are going to survive. And the rest of us, the 98% of the world population, are the ones who are going to be part of the serfdom, fiefdom that was going on in the Middle Ages of Europe.
Right. Now, you're arguing that this is being done as a policy or conspiracy or program or whatever. I would say that this is simply the natural and logical consequence of the kind of shakeout that happens every 80 years, every fourth generation, as a consequence of the economic and sociological cycles that happen. Strauss and Howe, in their book, The Fourth Turning, talked about this at some length. That there will always be you start with a generation that experiences economic disaster and war. That generation is followed by a generation who, because they grew up during the time of war and economic disaster, they quietly build. They work hard and they build the nation. That generation is followed by a generation that says, hey, you know, there's more to life than just building. We want to know about spiritual values. We want to seek, you know, enlightenment. We want to know more. And that generation in our day was, you know, the hippies in the 60s, and the last time around was Emerson and Thoreau, you know, the transcendentalists. Mm. And that generation then is followed by a generation that says, oh, all this navel-gazing stuff, it's a bunch of nonsense. These people are just crazy hippies. I want to make some money. I'm going to get mine. And it's, you know, me, me, me. And then the me, this fourth generation, this very, very, you know, totally centered, and this isn't a generation of people. I mean, this is a period of time, a cultural period of time, that those people are so greedy and so into using the system that they cause the system to crash into depression, which then leads to war, which brings us back around to that first generation again. So there's these four generations that repeat themselves, and every 80 years, roughly, each generation being about 20 years, every 80 years or so, you have a Great Depression and a war. And the 80 years ago, it was the Republican Great Depression of the 1930s. 80 years before that, it was the Whig Great Depression of the 1850s, which led to the Civil War. 80 years before that, it was the Great Depression of the 1760s and 1770s that led directly to the American Revolution. 80 years before that, it was the War of the Roses. 80 years before that, it was the British Revolution in the 1600s. I don't have the chart in front of me right now to give you all the details, but Strauss and Howe track it all the way back to the 1400s. Every 80 years this happens. and there is this kind of ringing out. And you see, and each of these four generations has their own archetypes. They have their own heroes. They have their own slogans, and they are all consistent. The things that were said in the 60s are the same things that were said by Thoreau and Emerson. The things that are being said in the post-Reagan era, the greed is good era, are the same things that were being said in the roaring 20s, you know, in the Coolidge era and the Hoover era.
Okay.
The things that will be being said over the next 5, 10, 15 years as we slide into the next Great Depression are going to be the same things that were said in the 1930s and the 1940s in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, from the music to the, you know, this whole thing. I find it fascinating, and I highly recommend this book. It was written in the 90s. I had them on the show back 6 years ago, and then I had them back on a year or so ago. Strauss and Howe, the book is called The Fourth Turning, and they also wrote a book called Generations, the Generations of America that preceded that. But I think The Fourth Turning is the best of their books. They have a new one out, too, or relatively in the last couple of years. But The Fourth Turning is just a classic in my mind. So I think that it's not that, you know, the old wealth is saying, okay, let's tighten the screws and bump these people out. I think it's that the cycle comes around and it produces that result. So maybe we're saying the same thing, but attributing different.
I think it's accelerated, though, isn't it? I mean, with the crash, I mean, Wall Street's taken everything away and made, you know.
Yeah, yeah. What's happening right now, and what has been happening basically since Reagan became president, is a massive transfer of wealth away from the middle class,
mm-hmm.
the equity of the middle class. It used to be when Reagan came to office in the 1980s. You had 40 years of the New Deal. You had 40 years of people who actually had equity in their homes. They owned their cars or a good chunk of their cars. Now people lease them, basically rent their cars. People don't own their homes. The bank owns their home. They have very little equity in their homes. You had people who had savings account were now in negative savings. You had people who, I was 24 years old when I got my first American Express card.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember it was a big deal. You know, it was 1975. I can finally get a credit card, you know?
Yeah.
And I was making good money at the time. In fact, I was making more money than my dad was at that time. But you know, I was only 24 years old. So it was really hard to get credit. Now the average American has $7,900 in credit card debt.
Well, you get a card as soon as you go to college at 18.
Hey, my cat gets card applications. I mean, you know, yeah, absolutely. And so what has happened is all of this is a way of transferring wealth, not income, wealth, the actual assets that people own, the true value, the true wealth, transferring that wealth from the middle class in the United States, which is frankly the largest repository of wealth in the United States, outside of, you know, the federally owned lands and things like that, to this very small group of very, very wealthy individuals.
The ones who run the world.
Yeah, or who at least think they run the world. But, you know, yeah, and to a large extent do run the world. And the only way to push back is to talk like Franklin Roosevelt did and say, you know, we're going to call these people out. We, you know, he called them the economic royalists, and he said, our faith and belief in America requires the overthrow of this kind of power. I mean, that is literally his speech in 1936. You can read it. I reprinted the entire speech in my book Screwed, as I recall, or maybe it was in Cracking the Code. He just calls for basically, you know, throw the bums out, overthrow the system, as it were, and change it. Chuck, thanks a lot for your call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270. Taking
my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you lost Iraq. So I'm taking my
yes, my friends, we are taking our country back. One House seat at a time, one Senate seat at a time, one dog catcher race at a time. Right across the board. And every week on this show, we bring to you one of the fine candidates who are running to take back our country and who are in close races and in need of your support. Today, Jeff Merkley on the line with us. Jeff Merkley is running against Senator Gordon Smith. in the great state of Oregon. And Jeff, it's M-E-R-K-E-L-Y. Jeff?
Yes, L-E-Y.
L-E-Y.
I'm L-E-Y. Sorry.
Thank you. I've got it spelled wrong. I thought that was, I thought it was, okay, M-E-R-K-L-E-Y, Merkley, as just like it sounds, .com. There you go. JeffMerkley.com. And Jeff is the Speaker of the House of Representatives in Oregon. He worked hard, earned scholarships, became the first in his family to go to college, went on to serve as a national security analyst, first for the Pentagon, then Congress. After returning to Oregon with his wife, Mary, he led Habitat for Humanity, worked with low-income families to help rebuild neighborhoods and purchase their first homes. Jeff Merkley, M-E-R-K-L-E-Y.com is his website, running against Gordon Smith. Gordon Smith, for the last two cycles, has been the guy who, in Oregon, for those of you who don't live in Oregon and don't know the story, he's been the guy who has been with not just Bush, but with the hard right, well over 90% of the time. And then in the year before the election, all of a sudden he starts becoming a moderate. And for some reason, the Oregonian and other local media refer to him as a moderate, but he's not. He's a hardcore right-winger. And Jeff Merkley is a good progressive, and he's taking him on, and he deserves and needs your support. Jeff, we were talking earlier in this hour with a right-wing anti-immigration guy, and I said, you know, I don't think we have an illegal immigrant problem in this country. We have an illegal employer problem in this country. If the reporting that was done by Willamette Week last week about Gordon Smith's frozen food company hiring people who are not citizens of the United States and don't have proper documentation is accurate, and there's every reason to believe that it is, that, you know, if we simply threw Gordon Smith in jail and a few other illegal employers, that, you know, a lot of folks who are here in this country illegally would say, hey, there's no job. I think I'll go back to Mexico. And so I'm not going to ask you if you think Gordon Smith should be tossed into jail, because it's a bit of a loaded question. But I just wanted to give you the backstory of what I've been talking about.
Right.
I will tell you, I think that the ads that he's been running are disgusting.
Oh, they're incredible. He's running the most negative campaign in the country. His most recent ad has been called the Willie Horton ad of 2008. And why is he running these negative ads? Because he has, and the answer is simply he's so out of sync with Oregon. As you mentioned, Tom, is 90% Bush-Cheney rubber stamp record in a state that I am so proud to say has the lowest opinion of Bush and Cheney of any state in the country.
That's great. That's great.
So he doesn't want to talk about his record. He can't talk about a vision, if you will, because it's either inconsistent with Oregon or inconsistent with the way he's voted. So it comes down to, if you can't help yourself, trash the other guy.
Yeah.
And I think Oregonians are just getting absolutely sick of it. While he's been doing this, my numbers have been climbing. Last three polls, it's a dead heat.
That's great. That's absolutely great. We're talking with Jeff Merkley. He's working to take on Gordon Smith in the United States Senate from the state of Oregon. Jeff Merkley, MERKLEY.com, the website. Get on over there. Toss him a few bucks. Help him out. Let's make this campaign work. What I found particularly ironic, Jeff, was that the early Gordon Smith ads, the ones that were running 2-3 months ago, showed Gordon Smith with Barack Obama. They showed Gordon Smith with Democrats. Yeah. With John Kerry. They were running John Kerry.
Yeah, no kidding. I kept expecting the Gordon Smith and Dennis Kucinich ad to come up. But it was very strange. For example, his ad with Barack Obama says, who says that Gordon Smith is a leader in alternative energy? Kind of a pause, and the answer is Barack Obama. And I thought, oh, my goodness, it's too bad that Barack Obama said such a thing. Well, of course, it turns out there is no such quote. The ad is a complete invention. When questioned how he could possibly put up an ad that was so contrary to the facts, he said, well, I signed on to the same bill that Barack Obama signed on to for CAFE standards, for better fuel efficiency for cars. But here's the thing. This is a bill that Smith opposed. He worked against it time and time again until he was running for re-election, and then he signs on to the bill so he can use it in a television commercial. And that's just the sort of politician that I don't think anybody in Oregon wants to have. I mean, I think we need to have somebody who fights for the things they believe in and believes in the things they fight for, not somebody who just changes themselves and pretends about their record to try to stay in office.
Jeff, you're a gentleman. You're using phrases like inconsistent with the facts. I would say Gordon Smith is a filthy liar. He is just a, you know, and you know, I realize these aren't the kind of words that you would use, but I will. The Gordon Smith is a liar. And he's a coward, by the way, as well. I've been doing a local show in Portland, Oregon for 3 years, and we used to every week call his office and ask if he would come on. He in fact has been in the building and walked down the hall and will not walk in and come on the program. He is totally afraid.
He has been hiding from Oregon voters. While I was out doing a 100-town tour with his tracker on me every step of the way, he basically, I don't think he did a public forum. The forums he did do in Oregon, he wouldn't announce ahead of time so that citizens couldn't go there. They were very controlled and managed.
Yep, and this is the guy that Karl Rove came to Oregon and said, let's divert some water, and what ultimately ruined much of the salmon habitat as a consequence of it, to throw a bone to a particular part of the electorate, the farmers in a particular part of Oregon, and create an ecological disaster in order to get Gordon Smith elected.
And it sure hurt the fishermen, I'll tell you, on the coast.
Yeah, it really did. And go ahead.
Well, you know, I keep trying to, you know, while Smith is bombarding me with this negative attacks, the reason I did this 100-town tour, and I did another 200 events in dining rooms and patios, is because I wanted to have a serious conversation with Oregonians about how we're going to create living wage jobs in this country, how we're going to create affordable health care, how we're going to have an energy policy, not Cheney's energy policy, but one that serves the United States of America and our citizens. And that's what I'm fighting to create in this campaign. And I know if I can get that message out on these positive issues, that we'll win this race.
Well, we've got to get you as our senator. We need another Democratic senator from Oregon, and you're a great man to do it. JeffMerkley.com, the website, MERKLEY, JeffMerkley.com. Get over there. Toss some help his way. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thanks so much, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from San Francisco, where Friday night, Norman Solomon and I are going to, we're doing a gig here. It's going to be a hoot. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'll give you a few more details about it in a second, but if you just go over to green960.com. You can get all the information. Green Nines, if you're in the San Francisco area, it's going to be at the Broadway Studios in North Beach in San Francisco. An evening with Norman Solomon and me and Angie. So 7 to 9 o'clock tomorrow night, the 19th. And you got to sign up. And you got to get over there. And it's going to be a hoot. And we're maybe we'll even get some books over there. But you can bring your books. I'll sign them. Anyhow. Cece is with us. Cece has been on our show before. She is the host of The Cutting Edge on our Anchorage, Alaska affiliate, KUDO, KUDO, AM Talk, AM 1080, isn't it, as I recall? Hey, Cece.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. And great to have you with us again. The Republicans are sending lawyers to Alaska to shut down the Troopergate investigation. What's the latest on this?
You know, Tom, I have to tell you, I so appreciate this opportunity because, really, Alaska needs America right now. What is happening in my city could happen in anybody's city. It is so much bigger than you could ever imagine. The McCain campaign has basically hijacked our government, and they have infiltrated our Department of Law. I have never seen anything like this in my entire life. This anti-terrorism prosecutor from the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York City, Ed O'Callaghan, has come into our state. They're calling it the Palin Truth Squad. We're calling it the Palin Smear Squad. They have held press conferences every day, absolutely attacking and vilifying anybody who in any way, shape, or form questions or attacks the governor in any capacity. They are just filleting people, throwing them under the bus. He is now advising and instructing our own Department of Law. Phone calls that are going to state offices are being rerouted to the McCain campaign.
Wait a minute. A political campaign has taken over a law enforcement agency?
This is what we have come to understand as of yesterday. Senator Willikowski, who called my show, gave us these two earthquake pieces of information. I mean, this story
have these people
has
never
got
heard of the Hatch
to stay
Act?
Out in the mainstream media because our own media is under McCain suppression.
You know, the Hatch Act specifically says that government personnel and government property cannot be used, or government personnel cannot be using government property or using the tools of government, whether it's, you know, a telephone or whether it's a an office or whatever it may be, for partisan political purposes. And it sounds to me like this has gone way beyond that.
Well, and the problem is we have no one to help us because everybody in our own government that would be advocating for the people is now in alignment with the McCain tactics. Our governor is out of state. Our lieutenant governor is out of state. I mean, for anybody to think that this is a Democratic smear is completely out of touch with the reality. This legislative council is stacked with 8 Republicans and 4 Democrats.
Now, hang on just a second. The legislative, for our listeners who don't have any idea what you're talking about, the legislative council is a subcommittee of the legislature of Alaska that is investigating Troopergate, that is investigating the possibility that Sarah Palin abused her power as governor, right?
Correct. 8 Republicans, 4 Democrats.
Right. And so now what's happened is the McCain group has sent lawyers in, and there's one guy in particular, to shut down this investigation.
Correct. But here's the thing. The Legislative Council is still committed. I mean, I spoke with Senator Lyda Green, who is from Wasilla, Governor Palin's hometown, okay? She's a Republican. They are committed to moving this forward. They're having a meeting tomorrow. But the Department of Law, this is where it gets intensely interesting, because this gentleman, Barnhill, he was the attorney for the Department of Law. He was representing this group of individuals in the Palin administration, okay? He came forward the other day and said, look, we need to agree on this one stipulation in order to move forward. The Legislative Council said, okay, we agree on your interpretation of this one thing. Let's go forward. So they started to schedule the depositions. That was Monday. The next thing we know, this guy Barnhill gets pulled off the case. And this guy, Ed O'Callaghan, arrives on the scene.
So a Republican who wants to look into corruption gets moved out of the way, and an out-of-state political operative who's actually a federal employee comes
in? Well, this guy, Mike Barnhill, he's an attorney.
But
he was pulled in by the Department of Law to be the attorney for this group of individuals working for the governor that have been subpoenaed to testify. And so he created this kumbaya moment, so to speak, that allowed everything to move forward as of Monday. That was the day this guy, O'Callaghan, was brought in on the scene. They removed Barnhill from the Department of Law. They put Callahan in its place. And then the Attorney General reneged the deal that was on paper and signed by Barnhill and the Department of Law with this Legislative Council. I mean, this thing is unbelievable.
This sounds like something out of a Sinclair Lewis novel about a small town in the South in the 30s, you know?
It is just the scariest, most breathtaking thing I have ever seen. It's one thing to spend the last 8 years reading about these kind of, you know, rogue tactics in the paper. It's another thing to have it come into your town and go after people that you know. I mean, you know, this guy, Stephen Branchflower, he's a 25-year veteran in the world of prosecution. Not too long ago, he actually wrote a scathing report as it relates to his work with Walt Monaghan. He is completely independent. Anybody who thinks that this is a Democratic smear, they need to understand this is a Republican-stacked legislature.
Right. It's Republicans investigating corruption and Republicans who actually want to investigate corruption. Alaskan Republicans who want to investigate Alaskan corruption. I mean, apparently the Republican Party in Alaska has had enough of the corruption already. And part of the corruption that they want to investigate is the corruption of the Palin administration and her husband's involvement with it as well. And so now Republicans from out of state are coming in and saying, we rather like the corrupt Republicans in Alaska, and the Republicans who want to stop the corruption, we're going to stop them. Is that
yeah? And now what's happening is now there's a split within the Republican Party, and a group of five Republicans filed their own suit against Branch Flower and the Legislative Council, where their own colleagues reside. These five Republicans filed suit to get this thing stopped.
So you've got now the pro-corruption Republicans are starting to come out of the woodwork to try to stop the anti-corruption Republicans. And the Democrats are just standing back going, hey, you know, we're only out of the 12 people on the committee, we're only four of them. You know, we got nothing going here. We're just watching the show.
Exactly.
That's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. We're talking with Cece. She does the afternoon show on Kudo, AM 1080 in Anchorage, the affiliate that carries our show, this show, KUDO1080.com, of course, is their website. Cece, what can our listeners all across the United States do? I mean, you said, you know, this is great that you're on a national show talking about this. What can our listeners do to help?
Well, I want to be honest and tell them that one thing they can do is they can stream our radio station, because we are the only ones in the media here in our state that's really getting this other side out. It has just been unbelievably sad to see our local media actually oppressed and suppressed by the McCain campaign.
Yeah.
The other thing they can do is see some of the blogs that are coming out of the state as well.
Right. So see, and people can do that at KUDO, KUDO1080.com is the website. And Cece, Eastern time, translate this into Eastern time, and then everybody can, because everybody can kind of translate against that. What time is your show on Eastern
time? My show's on at 3 o'clock. We are 4 hours behind the East Coast, so it would be 7 o'clock on the East Coast.
7 p.m.
7 p.m.
on the East Coast.
Right.
Which would be 4 p.m. On the West Coast and every place in between. And you can just go to 1080. Kudo1080.com and listen in, because if you want to hear some real interesting, the real inside skinny on what's going on in Alaskan politics.
And, you know, Tom, if people are asking themselves, well, how does this all relate, I want to just quickly show you how it relates. This ticket, this McCain-Palin ticket, is riding on Sarah Palin. We all know that they have done everything in their power to control and manipulate this woman's image to the country. If this thing gets out, their ticket is going to sink.
Yeah. Well, I think it already is sinking. I think the bloom is off the roses, as they say. You know, the novelty factor has worn off. But Cece, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom. I appreciate it.
And everybody, check out our show tonight, KUDO1080.com. You can stream the show there on our affiliate in Alaska.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dig a little deeper into this. Alaska State Senator Bill Willikowski is with us. AKSenate.org is the website where you can find out about the various senators. Bill Willick, am I pronouncing it right? Willikowski?
Yeah, Willikowski.
Thank you very much, Senator, for being with us.
Good to be here.
We were just talking with Cece of Kudo 1080 AM, our affiliate station there in Anchorage. And she said it's like the state government has been taken over, not by even the federal government, which I suppose Abraham Lincoln argued you could do, but by a political campaign, by the McCain campaign. What's going on in your state?
It unfortunately is looking more and more like that is the case. A couple different things going on. The McCain campaign flew in a guy named Ed O'Callaghan. He's one of the top counterterrorism prosecutors for the Bush administration. And they brought him in with the
So this guy's a federal employee.
Well, I don't know what he's doing. I assume he's on leave or something, but he's working for the McCain administration. He's holding press conferences on a daily basis, basically attacking anyone who dares to question or who dares to dissent from the Palin-McCain administration.
You mean campaign.
Yeah. And he is also admitted in Newsweek that he is working with the legal department here in devising legal strategies on Troopergate and perhaps other things, which deeply concerns me as an attorney, as a member of our Judiciary Committee, that we have an outside political campaign that's now come in and is essentially co-opting our what is supposed to be an independent legal department. That concerns me greatly. All questions now from reporters and even from constituents. I've gotten reports from constituents who have attempted to find out information from the Palin administration, and they've been directed to the McCain campaign.
Right. This, in some ways, reminds me in Florida in 2000, there were two guys in particular who went down there. One of them was John Bolton, who was leading the revolt. Him and Tom DeLay, a whole bunch of people from Tom DeLay's staff. But the other one was a lot more under the radar, a lawyer who had been a clerk for Justice Rehnquist, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and who was coaching the lawyers who were going to file lawsuit to stop the recount in Florida that the Florida Supreme Court had ordered. And he knew Rehnquist quite well, and so he knew how to argue before Rehnquist. So he coached these lawyers. He played the role of Rehnquist. And that was a fellow by the name of John Roberts, who was rewarded for his efforts in that, what I think, frankly, was a coup d'etat in the year 2000. By being now made the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court himself. This take-no-prisoners approach that the Republicans do, I mean, they play politics not for the good of the people, not for the good of the party. It's basically a take-no-prisoners game, and morality be damned. It's very Machiavellian.
This is we're getting reports now of reporters who are reporting against the McCain administration being threatened to be fired.
The McCain campaign. Let's not give them that status yet.
Well, yeah, the McCain campaign is going to the heads of television channels and newspaper reports, newspapers, and asking that people actually be fired when they issue reports that aren't supportive of the McCain campaign and the Palin administration.
We're talking with Bill Welikowski, who is a state senator in Alaska, and a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee there. And sir, is this just a holding pattern? Are they just trying to hold everything off until the election, or is there something even worse here going on?
Well, it's. You can just look at the facts. The Governor Palin had openly welcomed this investigation. The investigation in Troopergate was filed by state legislative council, which is composed of 10 Republicans and 4 Democrats. It was unanimous. It was a unanimous vote to move forward on the investigation. The governor welcomed it. She was open to it. She issued press releases for her entire staff to cooperate. The day after she was appointed vice president, the tone completely changed. She came out and asked that the investigation started smearing the investigators, started smearing the trooper. She hired a private attorney, and now, of course, we have the McCain campaign coming in and holding daily smear fests where they're attacking basically everyone who comes out on the side of trying to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah. And in the meantime, you've got a lot of national media there looking at this and probably being influenced by these daily press conferences. Bill Welikowski, the state senator from Alaska. Bill, thanks a lot Senator, thank you very much for being
great
with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for the overview. I appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour. Christy Harvey with News Under the Radar. What is being reported that's not being reported that we need to have reported that we need to know about? Check in with her right after this. Stick around. 27 minutes. Please.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
and gentlemen, please welcome the presumptive Republican candidate for president, Senator John McCain.
My friends, if I'm elected, I'm going to be getting on in years. I could be the oldest guy who's ever won. Hell, Ronald Reagan could be my son. Now look at the future, my second term. Think of what's in store. Now do you really want me running the country when I'm 84? There's gonna be some really sweet perks if I get the job. I will have advantages to get things done, like free boarding on Air Force One. And when I ask world leaders to dine, one thing is for sure, we never late night 'em, cause when I invite 'em, dinner's served at four. Every Easter Sunday, kids will Rolex at the White House, so I'll step outside and shout, hey kids, get off my lawn. When I ride in my limousine, I'll have one blinker on. Don't be concerned, my views are too old, I'm a modern guy. Many staunch conservatives you may have heard don't think evolution occurred. Well, they should ask me. I saw it firsthand with my dinosaur. I turned to a tadpole and then I met Bob Dole. The year we both turned four.
Indeed. Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Christy Harvey on the line with us. She's the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. Also, Mike Check Radio and MikeCheckRadio.com?
.org.
Thank you, Christy.
Right ballpark.
Yeah, there you go. And so the news under the radar, FEMA is as... by the way, Christy, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. That was a funny song today. I liked that one.
It was a good one. Louise finds some real gems and gets them on there. And greetings, by the way, from San Francisco. We're doing our show all this week. Well, Monday I was live from Lima, Peru, but the rest of the week here we're doing the show from Green 960, our affiliate here, and I'm doing a gig here Friday night. So.
Oh, well, lovely. Well, I bring you greetings from Dover, Delaware. So
oh,
I guess we're both a little displaced today.
We're both on the road. So FEMA is as cold as ice.
This was an interesting piece that I read this morning in on ABC News, and I don't think it's gotten enough play, and that's why I sent it over to you. It turns out that, if you remember, after Hurricane Katrina, FEMA got in a lot of trouble because it just was completely disorganized with how it was going to distribute ice.
Oh, they had ice trucks that were supposed to be going to Louisiana that were ending up in Maine.
Exactly. And then they put all this ice into storage facilities, and they were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to keep the ice frozen, and it was just completely wrong. They wasted tons of money because they weren't organized and because they didn't take the time to figure it out.
Now, was it that, or did they waste hundreds of millions or millions of dollars? Did they actually maybe not waste millions of dollars, but instead they figured out a very nice way to transfer millions of dollars to crony capitalist buddies of the Bush administration?
Well, there is a little bit of that also, but there was a lot of press about it last year.
Right.
And so very quietly, very secretly, last year they changed their bylaws and said, from now on, FEMA is just not in charge of bringing ice to destroyed areas. FEMA is not in charge. It's not our problem to bring ice into places that disaster has hit.
But wait
hit.
A minute. If all the power's out and you've got mm-hmm. diabetics, insulin has to be refrigerated, doesn't it?
Exactly. This, I'm not talking about, oh, no, people won't have enough to keep their gin and tonics cold. I'm saying that, you know, this is because you need it for food preservation. You know, all the grocery stores are going to have all their food rot, and you will have no food because there's no electricity. It's for medication.
Baby
like
formula
insulin.
Will become toxic. You know,
exactly,
bacteria
baby
will grow
formula. So they didn't announce this to anyone until April at the beginning of the hurricane season, even though they changed this last year. And they've never given any guidance to the states on how to produce and store and distribute ice on their own. And so all of a sudden, the states are flailing. States that have been hit, especially Texas, which was just hit by Hurricane Ike, they're flailing because they can't quickly get this ICE situation under control. And FEMA is just saying, hey, man, not our problem anymore. You deal with it.
Right. Speaking of Texas, Christy, I know that at the Center for American Progress, you guys keep track of a lot of things, including, you know, what is true and what isn't true. I have gotten so many emails, and I've seen a couple of websites now on this, that the Department of Homeland Security has declared no-fly zones over parts of areas around Galveston, where apparently dozens, maybe hundreds, maybe even thousands of people have died, and there are bodies floating in the water, and they will not allow reporters to fly over. They don't want these photos out. Is this the kind of, you know, vanishing hitchhiker story that typically follows a disaster, or is it true that the Bush administration has declared these no-fly zones and they're keeping the press out of these areas?
Well, I've heard that the fly zones are, in fact, restricted, and I know that we've got people looking into figuring out exactly why, and I know that there are a lot of investigative journalists out there that are doing the same thing. And the White House is saying, it's just, you know, for safety, trust us. Just trust us. There's nothing to see here. But I think that after what happened with Hurricane Katrina and what's continuing to happen with things like this FEMA story we just discussed, they don't get to get the benefit of the doubt anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I know a lot of people, though, this is a story definitely to keep your eye on, Tom, because a lot of people are trying to figure out exactly why these restrictions have been put in place.
Right. Why would it be that they don't want us to see what's going on? I mean, we're flying. When they had the tsunami in Southeast Asia, we were flying over those.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
China let us in to look at the earthquake.
And, you know, they're saying, I've seen on some blogs, they're saying it's similar to, for example, the Dover test, where they don't want people to photograph the bodies of the fallen troops as they come home and pass through Dover, Delaware. And they're saying it's similar to that. They're trying to control the flow of information. But as always happens with this White House, the more they try to control the flow, the bigger the story becomes when it finally breaks.
Right. Moving along, the American Psychological Association is, I think this is again taking a position on Guantanamo.
Yes, they are. They actually took a position on Wednesday and said that they have voted to prohibit any of their members from consulting or helping in the interrogations of detainees held down in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, or also in the so-called black sites that are operated overseas by the CIA. And they actually had a poll of all of their members about whether or not that was ethical behavior. And the group voted 8,700 and some to 6,000 in favor of putting a ban on this. And this has been a controversy that has gone on almost since the interrogation started. And when I say interrogations, I'm putting that in quotes, because what has happened is that the interrogators at places like Guantanamo and in these prisons and black sites have called on these the psychiatrists who are part of the American Psychological Association and said, can you help us break these people? Can you help us figure out how to torment these people to the point where they talk but maybe don't die? Or how can we inflict the most pain mentally on these people so we get what we want? And so there's been a lot of controversy over this one.
Yeah, first do no harm.
First do no harm, exactly. So this, they finally are saying, you know what, we're finally going to take a stand on this. If you're a member, you cannot do this.
Yeah, we are not Dr. Mengele.
Right.
The polls, I wanted to talk to you about the polls. I'm hearing that, well, at a certain level, common sense indicates there are a lot of people who don't have landlines. It is apparently in some states, and maybe even federally, illegal to call cell phones unsolicited. So they're not being polled. There aren't good directories of cell phones. Most people who have a cell phone, it's essentially unlisted. And that's the cohort that is massively supportive of Obama, people under 30 by and large. And so there's that question. And then you've got also, I mean, we had recently, I think it was Governor Sebelius came out and said that she felt that the polls were close because of racism. Clearly, that's probably a factor. But, you know, what's going on with the polls? What's your take on all this?
Well, I think, you know, we see this every election cycle, Tom. You really can't trust the polls as much as we could in the past, and even then you couldn't trust them completely, because, you know, people who are eating dinner at the time, for example, maybe might be Democrat or Republican or more likely to feel one way or another and are less likely to answer their phones or have cell phones. So you have to take it all with a grain of salt. However, I think that they still can show trend. I think that they still, the pollsters have been able to figure out how to tweak their methodologies to the point where I wouldn't get concerned with exact numbers, but I think it can show who's up and who's down in a fairly systematic way, although, you know, sometimes the polls are completely blown out of the water and completely wrong.
Yeah. Well, it looks, if that's the case, then it looks like the Palin bounce is gone.
Right. It looks like the Palin bounce is gone or has at least evened out. And there was a really interesting poll that I thought it was interesting, especially just because of what the narrative is that each of the campaigns is trying to push. And this poll asked voters if they thought that John McCain was an agent of change. And basically, voters came forward and said no. They said he is he's likely to continue Bush policies or come out with even more conservative policies than we've already seen.
Yeah, it was like 68%, wasn't it? Something like that.
It was, but 68% thought that the change is not likely from a McCain administration.
Remarkable. Christy Harvey, Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress. Thanks so much, Christy.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Good talking to you. AmericanProgress.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in the world?
It's not a good world right now, I got to tell you. People are really freaking out. They're freaking out in Washington. They're freaking out in New York. They're just freaking. Let's just start out with some pretty bad news. The jobless claims are up. They're now saying that it has to do somewhat with the hurricane, but they rose another 10,000 last week to 455,000 people. That's new first-time job claims, 500,000 people.
Wow. Now that, although very often when that happens, Wall Street actually goes up because they say, oh, you know, there's more jobs we can offshore, we can make more profit, we can pay people lower wages, stuff like that. But it's lousy news for the middle class, for the working class.
It's really lousy means. It's interesting that today the Republicans, many of them on Capitol Hill, were not very happy. They don't feel that they have been consulted. They feel that there is real question about how all of this gets done without notification. You had Scott Garrett of New Jersey, Tom Feeney of Florida, Tom Price of Georgia, Bachman of Minnesota, and they had a little discussion today on the Hill. They said enough is enough, and they said that they have got to bail out the taxpayer from bailout mania. And so some of the Republicans are really objecting loudly to this. Also today, the Democrats had another press conference. They were mainly talking about the low income energy assistance, the LIHEAP funds, and the CHIP program. And Senator Reid was very upset. He said there were secret meetings between Congress and the administration to lay out the government assistance measures, obviously not with Democrats. And he said, I think that there's more than one branch of government. So he was very upset. Steny Hoyer said today that there's going to be hearings in both the Financial Services and Oversight Committees. Meanwhile, Dana Perino went way after the Democrats and said that they have asked for all kinds of things in terms of financial services transparency, and they haven't gotten it. And she said that
the administration has asked for this?
She said yes, that throughout the years.
But it's the Republicans who put all these loopholes into place.
I just report the news.
Yeah, okay.
All right. She said that she doesn't think that the reaction of finger-pointing from Democrats to the White House is anything new. And here she said, in fact, it was the White House that worked to try and get them to act on GSC reform as early as 2003. They did not act until most recently when there was a crisis. What we're looking for in the GSC reform was a strong regulator. That's what we wanted. It was more regulation, more transparency, and a stronger independent regulator to actually look at the books.
I can't believe, I can't believe she's saying this. It's like the McCain camp running these ads that are transparent lies. You've even got Newsweek and CBS calling them lies. I mean, actually using that word. And now Dana Perino doing essentially the same thing about the, this economic mess on our watch. It's not our fault. You know what amazes me, Ellen, is that 9/11 happened when George Bush was president. If 9/11 had happened when Bill Clinton was president, he would have been damned and vilified for it. He'd be the guy who let it happen, blah, 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 blah. I don't understand why the nation doesn't say, George Bush let 9/11 happen, and now they're trying to weasel out of, George Bush and John McCain and Sarah Palin and all the other Republicans, letting this economic disaster, actually causing this economic disaster, if they're going to wiggle out of this as well as they wiggled out of responsibility for 9/11.
I just want to report one little more. Well, there's lots of news to report, but I just, as long as you're on, as you would say, a rant,
yeah.
I'm going to give you a little more fodder.
Okay.
President, as you know, made a talk this morning, and he was asked by our very own Victoria Jones, what was the decision-making process in not having the president give a prime-time address, given the seriousness of the financial situation? Dana answered Victoria, he wanted to talk to the American people as soon as possible. Now that we all have a 24-hour news cycle, I don't know if prime-time matters so much anymore.
Oh, that's interesting.
I'm hearing dead silence.
Yeah, no, I said I'm still here. I said that's interesting. Do you think that there might be some truth to that, or do you think that basically that was just a way of weaseling out of the question?
I can't decide. But I think that, one, why not make a remark in the morning and also perhaps make a remark later if this is such a major thing? I wanted to talk to you before the market's opened or at the market's open. I also want to talk to you tonight when the market's closed.
Right, yeah.
Maybe what I would have done, but
yeah.
Hey, I'm not President of the United States.
I think you'd make a pretty good one, actually, given what we've seen over the last 8 years.
A couple other things, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York today put $55 billion into the temporary reserves of the U.S. They said it was to ameliorate the spike in overnight lending rate between banks, which could make banks reluctant to loan to each other. Secretary Rice also said today in a speech that the Russian invasion of Georgia last month was a critical moment for Russia. Now, listen to this. She said that she criticized Russia for becoming authoritarian at home and aggressive abroad. And then she said that this could make Russia increasingly isolationist.
Well, that's interesting. Sort of like, a country that passes a law that says that it can wiretap its own citizens and it can hold them, does away with habeas corpus, and then drops bombs on a country that never attacked them.
Me thinks people in the glass houses.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, stones and glass houses. Perfect metaphor. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. A great website, great news site. Check it out. Ellen, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you, as always. Tomorrow, it's Friday. So, of course, it'll be Brunch with Bernie. And we're going to ask Ravi Batra, our favorite economist, to drop by and make some sense out of the craziness on Wall Street. That should be an interesting conversation. And anything goes Friday. Your calls and anything you want. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. It's not enough to just vote. Get out there, get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.